from KQED. From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, how to make stress your friend. But wait, everyone from our doctors to the media tells us that stress is the enemy, robbing us of our health, of sleep, and of time with kids. But health psychologist Kelly McGonigal says that with stress, it's not so much good or bad, it's how you look at stress that determines whether it's a health hazard. Her new book is called The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. In it, she says stress can make us stronger, smarter, and happier. So to paraphrase a saying, if you can't beat it, get good at it. Stay with us for Forum. It's coming up after this. From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Mina Kim. Stanford's health psychologist Kelly McGonigal's new book about stress offers up a counterweight to most of what we read these days. It's called The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. Now, most of us feel we are swimming in messages about the benefits of eliminating stress from our lives. A quick survey of stress-related book titles on Amazon shows that other than Kelly McGonigal's book, Stress-Free Living, Reducing Stress, and Stress Management definitely dominate the category. Nothing there about the benefits or the upside of stress. But McGonigal argues in her book and in a TED Talk on the topic that stress need not always be harmful, and in fact, it can make a person more resilient, stronger, healthier, and even happier. So to explain how this is so, Kelly McGonigal is joining us for this hour on Forum. Kelly, thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, thanks for having me, Penny.
Well, you say that you used to believe and teach even that stress was harmful and the enemy, and that you then changed your mind. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what made you change your mind.
Yes. Well, so I'm a health psychologist, and I studied psychology and medicine, and I basically made a career out of telling people that stress was toxic and the enemy, and the key to improving well-being is to reduce or avoid stress. And that's what I learned in my training. But in 2011, I came across this epidemiological study that it rocked my world. And this was a study that followed 30,000 Americans over time to look at the impact of stress on mortality rates. But they had included a very interesting question at the beginning of the study, which was about how people thought about stress. They didn't just ask people, how stressful is your life? They asked people, do you believe that the stress in your life is harmful for your health? And then they followed people for about a decade to see who died. And this particular study found that the presence of stress in your life, high levels of stress, only increased your risk of mortality if at the beginning of the study you also viewed stress as very harmful for your health. And the people who were most likely to be alive at the end of the study, they were the ones who had very stressful lives but did not hold that particular view of stress. They didn't view it as harmful. And in that paper, the epidemiologists actually estimated that 20,000 Americans a year were dying not from too much stress but from this interesting combination of stressful lives and viewing stress as harmful. And when I read that paper, I practically stopped breathing because it blew my mind. It suggested that not only was stress not inevitably harmful, but that what I was doing and what we in psychology and medicine were doing, basically trying to convince people, persuade people that stress was harmful, might actually be amplifying any of the potential harm of stress. So that set me on a journey to try to figure out, like, okay, it was just one study. It was a correlational study. It was a good one. But it doesn't necessarily prove that how you think about stress determines its effects on your well-being. And so about 4 years ago, I really started this journey of trying to figure out, is that true? And if it's true, is there a better way to think about stress?
And then were there lots of follow-up studies or is there a series of studies then beyond this one? And granted, this one with 30,000 people, that's a lot of people. That's a good sample size. But then are there a number of studies that have corroborated that make it clear that stressing out about stress is the problem? It's not stress in and of itself.
There are a couple of different areas of research that I think really support this. You know, there are other studies showing, looking at epidemiology, showing that, for example, viewing your stress as harmful increases your risk of stress-related heart disease. But also there was research that originally started coming out of Yale looking at how viewing stress as positive can actually be protective, that people who view their own stress response and the stress in their lives as helpful, as opportunities to learn and grow, that they actually were happier and healthier and more productive at work. And that actually taking people who view stress as harmful and inviting them to take a more positive view of it by educating them about the benefits of stress, that seemed to make people happier and healthier and more productive, even in highly stressful circumstances. And I think the last area of research that really hit home with me is the area of research looking at what happens when you set the goal to avoid stress in your life. And that's often a consequence of viewing stress as toxic. You think, well, if something is stressful, then I should try to escape it. I should try to avoid whatever is giving rise to stress. And there's this whole other area of research showing that people who simply have the goal to avoid stress end up coping with difficulties in their lives in a way that exacerbates any potential negative outcomes and really makes it less likely that they'll be able to reach their goals. And I think putting all of that together, it made me want to change the way that I teach and write and think about stress so that people are less likely to set the goal to avoid stress and are able to think about stress and the benefits of stress in a way that really allows them to engage with the challenges in their lives in a way that makes it more likely they'll reach their goals and also makes it less likely that they will experience any of the harmful side effects of stress.
Yeah, because I don't know how one can live a life and avoid stress. I mean, by definition, life is stressful because any experience you have, I mean, life basically involves new experiences and new things by nature are stressful. That's stressful for us. So
yes,
right there,
fact,
that's, you know, by definition, then life is stressful.
Life is stressful, and one of the earliest definitions of stress that was offered up by Hans Selye, who's considered the grandfather of stress research, he actually defines stress as the body's response to any demand or change, which, you know, if you think that the body's response to anything that requires you to do something or adapt in any way, that that's a toxic response, you know, of course we're going to fear our own lives. But it's actually, you know, much more appropriate to think about stress as something that arises when anything we care about is at stake. And research even shows that people who have more meaningful lives actually have more stress in their lives.
When did stress become enemy number one? Because there's never been a time when people haven't lived enormously stressful lives. And I think about how, you know, 100 years ago, people lived with the fear that if their child got sick, their child might die. So you must have lived your entire life with enormous stresses just in daily living and stresses of life and death. So when did we become obsessed with eliminating stress from our life?
You know, it really seems to go back to the work of Hans Selye. He was the person who coined the term stress. And he studied rats. He looked at what happened to rats when he was basically torturing them in the laboratory. You know, he was exposing them to extreme temperatures, isolating them, injecting them with poisons. And he found that basically anything you can do to a lab rat that seems really uncomfortable and unpleasant seemed to make the rat sick. Often they would die. And he thought that the one thing that sort of they all had in common was that the rats were unable to cope with these challenges or these demands that they were facing, and that whatever he did to them, that it was somehow creating a toxic response in the body. And he called that toxic response stress. You know, his idea was that when you are faced with this type of adversity or these types of unhealthy situations, your body mounts a response that is fundamentally toxic. And he watched it as, you know, the rats got sick and died off. And then he extrapolated that to humans, which is a funny leap in logic because he didn't study humans. He never went and looked at, you know, how humans deal with adversity. He just said, I bet what's happening in my rats is happening to humans. And every time we experience something that's difficult, I bet that our bodies are producing that same kind of toxic response. And he actually started touring the world, telling people about stress and how life itself was fundamentally toxic. And this became, you know, quite a popular message in medicine and in psychology, despite the fact that almost all of the research that suggests stress is uniformly toxic comes from studies of basically torturing rodents. And all of the science that looks at the role that adversity and our own physical stress response plays on human well-being, that's a much, much more complex set of findings. And yet the ones that we usually hear about are the ones that suggest that stress is always harmful.
And yet you found that if you don't perceive stress, if a person is exhibiting, well, you didn't find, but in your work you were showing that if a person exhibits the physical manifestations of stress, so the racing heart and the sweating and all of that, but they're not perceiving stress in their own experience as toxic, they're perceiving it in another way, in a more positive way, their physical manifestation might be the racing heart, but it's not the constricting of the blood vessel. It's the maintaining of a regular sized or an open blood vessel. And that's similar to either exhilaration or, I think you say, courage, right?
Yes.
So that's a positive. So, that's a strong response.
It is. This is one of my favorite areas of it. The research on really embracing stress. This comes from the work of Jeremy Jameson, who's now at the University of Rochester in New York. And he found that, well, first of all, he was an athlete, and he knew that in sports, everyone understands that stress helps you do well. You actually try to amp up adrenaline in order to perform your best. But even athletes and his fellow college athletes before exams, they would say to themselves, oh my gosh, the stress is going to make me choke. They viewed the same symptoms of physical stress, the adrenaline, as being harmful in one context, but really helpful and desirable in another context. And he actually came to think, like, that doesn't make any sense. Because when you look at the research on how to perform well under pressure, whether it's an exam or negotiating a contract or business deal or having to give a public talk, that in general, being amped up really helps performance. People do better the more adrenaline they have. Even in situations where we think we should be calm, the opposite seems to be true. And yet we have this misunderstanding that our own anxiety and stress impairs performance. And so he set out creating these very short mindset interventions where he tells people who are about to be really stressed out by taking an important exam or giving an important talk, he says to them, you know, when your heart is pounding, that's your body trying to give you energy. And research shows that anxiety can actually help you perform better. So if you notice the physical symptoms of stress, just remind yourself that that anxiety could be helping you perform, could really help you rise to the challenge. And those mindset interventions in the midst of stress actually, as you said, transforms people's physical stress responses. They're still stressed out. In fact, they often end up releasing even more adrenaline than people who aren't embracing their stress. But they don't show some of the signs of stress that we view as unhealthy or unhelpful. So they might release lower levels of cortisol, or they might experience less inflammation in the body. These aspects of the stress response that can be toxic. They're still stressed out, but it's a completely different physiology of stress. And I think that's one of the most important ideas in the book and in the science, is that there's more than one way to have a stress response. And we're so used to thinking that every experience of stress is toxic to us that we often try to calm down, or maybe we get drunk, or we try to distract ourselves to try to suppress the stress, when in fact there are many ways to transform our own stress response into something that really does help us.
And you hear about, you know, really seasoned performers, everyone from, say, a Barbara Streisand or, you know, somebody who's been on stage their whole life, and they still get enormously scared before they go on stage and deliver a killer performance, because that either it's that amount of respect for being on stage or that amount of adrenaline that's channeling this phenomenal performance. I don't know, you know, why, but that's how
well, it's
much.
Because they care,
right?
And it's because their body wants to help them rise to the challenge. And so often we view that anxiety or that stress as a sign that our body is betraying us. And, you know, one of the messages I really want people to understand is that even if it feels distressing, like even if you think you'd rather be calm, it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you or that you can't handle the stress that you're facing just because your heart is pounding or you're experiencing anxiety or overwhelm. Those are often signs that actually your body is getting ready to give you access to your resources.
You know, I've talked to this one person who mentioned before very stressful events, he said to me one time, well, do you have butterflies? And I said, yes, about something I was doing. And he said, that's good. You should have butterflies. Now you have to make them fly in formation. So that was his approach to it, is of course you should have butterflies. Now your job is to make them do what you want, which I've always thought about anytime I entered into a stressful situation is, good, you got the butterflies. That makes you work better. Now just make them do what you want, which I thought was a lovely image. Well, talk a little
one
bit
way to think.
I'm sorry.
I was going to say one way to think about stress is that it's energy and you get to decide what to do with that energy. In some moments, the right thing to do with that energy might be to take action. In some moments, it might be to motivate you to make an important change in your life. And sometimes you just redirect the energy and you go for a run because you can't actually change or fix anything in the moment. But I think I love that idea of really deciding what to do with the energy that stress is giving you.
Talking this hour with Dr. Kelly McGonigal. She is the author of The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You, and How to Get Good at It. And if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. That's a toll-free number. Or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. And you can find us at Facebook there as well and leave a comment there. Now, a lot of this, it seems to me, is based on personality. Because I think about how many people I know who love stress. I mean, I don't know that they know that they love stress, but they thrive under a conflict situation. They love tension. They love battle. They love deadlines. And stress is sort of a way of life. What is it about the personalities that seem to thrive under stress and the personalities of those who are paralyzed by it? And it crushes them.
Well, so the good news is there's actually more than one way to thrive under stress. So the way that you described, I think of as being sort of the adrenaline junkies. These are people who actually like the way stress feels. They're used to thinking of it as energy. And they enjoy that particular chemical cocktail of a stress response that includes not just adrenaline, but also dopamine and sometimes endogenous opioids. You get a kind of a high out of a stress response. And it's why some people like jumping out of airplanes. And those folks often do well in very stressful environments. They like rushing to meet the deadline. They like challenging themselves or competing with others. But, I am not that kind of person at all. I'm much more the sort of the anxious type who would greatly prefer things to be nice and calm and predictable. And yet I found my way to thrive under stress, which is a very different way, instead of sort of going out and seeking the adrenaline, to actually appreciate some of the other ways that our bodies and brains are well adapted to handle stress and adversity. One thing we haven't talked about yet is that part of the brain and the body's way of responding to stress is to motivate you to connect with others and actually help you be more caring and help you strengthen social bonds. Another way that the brain and body are well adapted to deal with stress is we have a natural biology of learning and growing from adversity and being able to make meaning out of that. So in order for me to become better at stress, I embrace my personality, which is that you could never get me to jump out of an airplane. You'd have to push me out. But I can embrace the part of me that really enjoys finding meaning in growing and learning, and choosing to view stressful situations as an opportunity to learn and grow. And that fits my personality, and that allows me to thrive. Many people, the best way for them to learn how to thrive is to embrace the part of their personality that really likes social connection and support. And you can choose to view stress as a catalyst for connecting with others, for caring with others, that can increase empathy and compassion. It can help us create supportive communities. So I think the key to thriving under stress is not to think that you have to become someone who loves that particular stereotype of stress, but sort of find your own way of harnessing our natural instincts for dealing with adversity.
Well, you talk in your book about transforming stress itself, and that's what you were just referring to and how you yourself adapted to it. Talk about how you help others then do this when you're teaching the idea of finding the upside of stress to people and helping guide people into this way of thinking about stress. How do you go about it? How do you help turn a person's mindset away from the toxicity framework and towards an embracing of a very natural feeling?
Well, I think there are really three steps to working with your own mindset towards stress. And one is to just begin to pay attention to what your mindset is. I call that mindset mindfulness. You know, we are so used to hearing messages from the media and from other people in our lives that stress is toxic. And if we're stressed out, it's a sign that there's something wrong with us or there's something wrong with our lives. And to start to notice thoughts and feelings and messages that create that sense of, if I'm stressed out at work, then I can't handle it. Or if I'm stressed out as a parent, there's something wrong with me as a parent or something wrong with my kids. To start to pay attention to how that sort of that fundamental belief that stress is a signal that there's something wrong with you or your life, that can actually lead us to cope with our lives in ways that are destructive. And paying attention to that is really important because otherwise it becomes a kind of an intellectual debate. You know, I actually don't think it's the most helpful thing to do to try to line up the evidence and say, well, there's 40% of evidence that says stress can give you a heart attack, but 60% that says it might create health and well-being. Actually, you know, both are always going to be true. Stress is an incredible paradox. And what I'm most interested in is the effect that how you think about stress in your own life, not in general, but the stress you experience and your own capacity to handle that, how that affects your actual well-being and ability to cope. And so just start to pay attention to that.
And can I interrupt you there? Because it's all so definitional, isn't it? Because when somebody says they're stressed out at work, what does that really even mean? I mean, because you would think to yourself, well, on one hand, I mean, everybody says they're stressed out at work, first of all. But what does that mean? Do you want to always stay in your comfort zone? Because if you're stressed out at work, maybe it means you've got a lot on your plate and you're being pushed and there's you're being a little bit pushed out of your comfort zone. But isn't that maybe a good thing? You don't want to always be in your comfort zone. So it's always this definitional thing of, do we want to live inside the envelope or do we a little bit want to push ourselves out of the envelope, which necessarily means we're going to be a little stressed out?
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes the stress is good in that way. And sometimes you're having stress because the workplace, the demands are unsustainable or your boss is a jerk and it's an abusive relationship. And then you have stress to motivate you to do something about it, whether it's to speak out against what you perceive as wrong, or whether it's your ability to take action and go outside your comfort zone to try to find another job. That stress, you know, stress is a signal that something that we care about is at stake. And we spend so much time and energy thinking we need to fix that signal. And I actually think it's much more useful to pay attention to it and to trust it rather than think, you know, well, I'm just going to spend my energy trying to calm down, or I'm, you know, watch 10 episodes of something on Hulu so that I don't feel like my job is killing me. But, you know, that stress is actually telling us that we should choose something, and we should choose something that we care about.
That is,
and it doesn't necessarily mean that the situation is good. That stress can help us change it as well.
All right. That's Kelly McGonigal, author of The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. And we will be hearing more about the ideas in the book and the ways in which we can get good at both understanding our own stress and also embracing it and using it to embrace maybe things that we can be learning about how to improve our own lives from it. You're listening to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Mina Kim, and we'll be talking more after a short break. This is WD. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, and we're talking this hour with Kelly McGonigal, the author of The Upside of Stress and also the author of The Willpower Instinct. And this hour, we are talking about stress, and we have a lot of emails coming in and some calls. And if you'd like to join in the conversation, the number to call is 866-733-6786. 866. That's 866-733-6786. And let's go right to the phones. We've got Janelle calling from San Francisco. Hi, Janelle.
Hi. thank you for accepting my call. And Kelly, I wanted to thank you because I had heard your TED Talk at a time when I had a lot of work-related stress in my life. And it's sort of ironic because it was my boss at my employer who actually linked me to the TED Talk and linked like everyone in our department. And I performed the exercise of sort of like monitoring the stresses that I was feeling and like trying to change my perception of the stress. And I wasn't able to. And I realized it wasn't, it's not my reaction to the stress. It was really like the input in my life that were causing the stress that I didn't enjoy. And I've made drastic changes in my life. I've left that employer and I now have more stress than ever, more stressors than ever, more things, more balls in the air. But there are things that I enjoy and there's stresses that I can appreciate and understand. So, and just take in a better way. So I just wanted to kind of acknowledge that you don't live your life in a vacuum of stressors, you know, fixed inputs that you have to react to in a certain way. You can also change the input.
All right. Thanks, Janelle.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Janelle. I think that's a fabulous example of how you need to pay attention to what stress is trying to signal. That, you know, in the TED Talk I talked about, you could think about stress as energy and a sign that you could handle a challenge. I said you could think about stress as an opportunity to connect with others. But sometimes the reason that you're stressed out is that something in your life really needs to change. And if you cannot find meaning or any sort of, you know, if you can't find your own values in the thing that's causing stress, and it's something you can change or control, and stress is probably a signal that you should do that. And Janelle gave a great example of how it's often not, you know, the presence of stress that matters, but whether you're able to find some kind of meaning in that stress. And then the stress is much more tolerable.
All right. Let's go to Catherine calling from Berkeley. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. This has probably been one of the best shows that I've heard in a long time. I just wondered if you guys could comment about how others react when you're stressed. I know I'm one of those people who actually thrives on stress, and I find myself putting myself in stressful situations all the time because I enjoy it and I rise up to the challenge, and that's really rewarding for me. But, you know, people will notice that I'm really stressed, and then they'll let me know that I'm stressed as if I don't know. And I'm like, I know, you know, that's fine. But it really affects them. And, you know, it brings a different energy to an environment when somebody is very stressed. And I wondered, you know, if you could just comment on kind of that aspect of it.
Yeah. So, you know, one thing that I often tell people is that how you react to other people's stress really sends an important message. And you know that you thrive on stress. But, you know, imagine someone who isn't quite sure about their own ability to thrive under stress. And when they start to feel anxious or they're starting to act like that, you know, they have that adrenaline and they're rushing or they're feeling pressured. And someone else in their life says, whoa, you need to calm down. This is too much. You're stressed out. The message that people often receive is, I don't think you can handle this, or this isn't right for you, or there's something wrong with you for being stressed out right now. And that message may actually be more harmful than the stress itself. I mean, one of the things we know is that stress is most likely to be detrimental when someone doubts their own ability to handle whatever the situation is. And sometimes people send messages that basically create that impression that I don't think you can handle this. I think it's really important for people to think about how they react to other people's stress. And if you are someone who's triggered by other people's stress, right, you know, and you're trying to get them to calm down because you feel like their stress is contagious, you know, and you don't want to catch their stress, it's a great opportunity to actually think about your own ability to handle other people's stress, that actually this is something that is not necessarily toxic to you to be around. And I've even started to see media reports saying that, you know, stress is contagious, therefore it's toxic and people should be hiding their stress, or you should protect yourself by not being around other people who are stressed. And that's kind of silly, because the other thing we know is that social isolation, whether you're hiding your own stress or whether you're isolating yourself from others, that's way more toxic than the presence of stress in your life. And so I think that people should really think about strengthening their ability to be in the presence of stress, whether it's their own or others, and to trust that that stress can be transformed into something more positive.
Catherine, let me ask you, when you are stressed out and you enjoy being stressed out, do you send out a vibe of enjoying it, or is it kind of like, oh my God, I got too much to do and da 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 da? So do you send out a positive vibe or sort of a negative vibe, even though you're enjoying it inside yourself? Because I think they might be perceiving a negative thing and you're actually sort of digging it, but they're not. And it would be really what you're sending out.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely the case. You know, whenever I'm stressed and I can think, I witnessed this in many people in my own life. You know, you kind of get tunnel vision on what you're focusing on, and it gives you that, you know, energy to accomplish the task at hand. And I think I do kind of lose awareness about, you know, the signals that I'm sending to other people in order to focus on what I'm trying to get done. And I think, you know, that absence of personal awareness is one of the reasons that people, you know, try to make me aware of myself. But, you know, I think that that's kind of the product of being in an empathetic society, of, you know, people seeing your emotions and then also having this kind of mirror that we're living in where people also try to reflect back at you what you're sending off. But it's, you know, I am aware of what I am sending out, and I realize it's negative sometimes, or it could be perceived that way. But at the same time, I'm internally having a good time, and that's what I need to do for myself.
Maybe you just need to tell people, I love being stressed.
I do. They don't believe me.
Okay.
Thank you so much again for coming.
All right, Catherine. Thanks a lot. Kelly, we've got an email here from Michael Friedman at Columbia University School of Social Work, and he's giving a little bit of pushback. Oh, I'm sorry, and I'm being told by the producer it's not an email. It's a Huffington Post response to your book. So it's not an email. It's a response from the Huffington Post, off of the Huffington Post, from Michael Friedman, and it's a response to your book. And it says, whatever studies there are that seem to show that stress can be our friend, there are plenty of studies that show that stress sometimes is very damaging. There's a link between poverty and poor health, for example. Recently, there's been a lot of attention to the impact of adverse childhood events on physical and mental health later in life. And we know, despite the evidence that McGonigal mentions, that helping others is good for one's mood and sense of self, that bearing the brunt of caring for a family member with a long-term disability, such as dementia, it takes a terrible toll on many people. Not all, but many. So that's some pushback. Yes. From Michael Friedman.
I think it's in response probably to my TED Talk, because my book addresses these things. Mm-hmm. And I actually think it's very helpful pushback. One of the problems of giving a 10-minute talk is that you can't address some of these really important paradoxes of stress, and the fact that things that I would really define as adversity or suffering can lead to very damaging effects. And so actually I appreciated getting that kind of pushback, because it became an opportunity to address it in more detail.
And let me piggyback on mm-hmm. that with one more that's a critical email that comes in, and then you can kind of put it all together. This email
sure.
says, it's difficult to hear the hypothesis without thinking it's tone deaf to the realities of poverty and folks living in our anxiety-ridden first world society. Stress from wondering where your next meal will come from, if you'll be evicted by not having rent at the end of the month, or when an abuser may reoffend. So again, sort of a similar sort of thing. But if you can respond to both of those, and maybe also use this as a jumping off point to talk about your connection section of the book, about how stress creates an avenue for connection because of the oxytocin chemical release that comes about when one is stressed.
Sure. So one of the things that I want to start with is by distinguishing between saying that there's an upside to stress and saying that suffering is good, or poverty is good, or hardship is good. You know, the type of stress that I'm talking about is really the human capacity to respond to adversity, which has been demonized, actually. We've turned that instinct, that capacity, the physical stress response and all of that into a state that needs to be suppressed or controlled. And I'm actually quite interested in working with populations of people who are suffering in ways that are not controllable or easily fixed, not the job stress, but being homeless, being unemployed, being a survivor of serious trauma, dealing with domestic violence. And this is something that I'm quite committed and passionate about. And in all of those situations, the thing that seems to interact with that kind of adversity or trauma to produce the worst outcomes, things like depression and post-traumatic stress disorder and physical illness, is the sense that it is completely against your will, outside of your control, and that you are alone in your suffering. And there's nothing that you are sort of fundamentally inadequate to the adversity in your life, the reality of your life. And that often leads to the defeat response, which is a particular kind of stress response that increases illness and increases depression. And when you think about how it is that we talk about stress and think about stress, in the book I talk about work with people who are currently unemployed and many are homeless and many have escaped abusive relationships. And I talk in that section about how a typical sort of stress management intervention is to have them check off every stressful life event they've experienced. And it gets a number score, which you add up, and then it tells you how toxic your life is. And of course, everyone in this group has a score that says you are at increased risk of dying or getting sick. And so the next step should be to try to eliminate or avoid any life crises in the future. And I think that that's what I'm talking about when I talk about the upside of stress is not about saying, so you should be grateful to have gone through this experience of violence or poverty, and we should all try to be poor because it's good for us. That's sort of the idiot version of this message. What I'm saying is it's really unhelpful to tell people that the reality of their lives is toxic and that there is nothing that they can do to transform that adversity in any way. And I think that it can be really challenging to try to hold those opposite truths at the same time, that poverty can lead to health problems, and also hold at the same time really interesting research, for example, the work of Edith Chen that shows that childhood adversity, including poverty or violence, does not necessarily lead to increased health risks. And a lot of it depends on whether or not people are able to find meaning or find hope in their situation. And so I'm mostly interested in how to help people find that meaning or find that sense of trust in themselves or create a supportive community that allows them to continue to persist in the face of whatever reality is. And what I'm really trying to push back against is not the fact that suffering is harmful and we should be trying to reduce it. I'm trying to push back against the message that if you found yourself in a situation of adversity or suffering, you are doomed to be damaged by that.
And talk about, I mean, this speaks directly to what you talk about with resilience, that stress, in fact, and of course, these are extreme cases that you were just referring to, but in the more general sense, that if one can work with and in some way embrace how you do it, you talk about in the book, but stress, it can, in fact, build resilience. It can, in fact, make it more doable to tackle these difficult circumstances in life. Resilience, connectivity, these are things that do come about by learning to sort of manage or embrace the stress.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that the science is pretty clear about is that if you go through something that is truly traumatic, real adversity, that the most likely outcome is that you will suffer because of it, that you will experience harm, and you will also experience benefits and growth. That's the normative outcome. And the growth sometimes takes longer, or the benefits sometimes take longer. And a lot depends on whether, as you deal with the reality of the harms that you've suffered, if you are able to begin to construct meaning out of it, to try to tap into that natural human instinct, to try to transform your suffering into something better. For example, by trying to help other people who are struggling in a similar way, to rely on religious faith, or to view it as an opportunity to strengthen your own values or find a new direction in life. And in the book, I give a lot of examples of how this plays out that really doesn't deny the fact of suffering and looks at how those two opposites can be true at the same time. I talk about a woman whose husband was killed in the September 11th terrorist attacks, and a woman whose child was born, stillborn. And how even those situations that nobody would ever ask for themselves or wish on anyone they care about, circumstances that led to tremendous grief and suffering over time also led to growth and meaning in a way that was valued by the people who went through them. And I think that knowing that that is actually the case, the research shows that even just knowing when you're going through something very difficult, that in the long term, that it is likely that you will also grow in a meaningful way, that actually makes that growth more likely and allows people to experience some sense of hope in the midst of whatever is the very dark reality of despair.
All right, let's go back to some of our callers. We've got Stuart calling from Sonoma. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. It's a very interesting topic, and I'm wondering how it relates to how stress and our ability to deal with it and what we take from it relates to the sense of control that we have over a situation. There are a lot of studies from the military and for business where if people feel they have some level of control or the illusion of control over a situation, their response is much different than if they feel they have no control. Pilots in the military in two-seater airplanes landing on a carrier have high stress levels, but they deal with it much differently than the people sitting in the back seat of the airplane, because the people in the back seat perceive they have no level of control. And I'm wondering, you know, when you talk about managing stress and learning from it and realizing there's a hopeful outcome potentially, if that isn't tied into people feeling they have a sense of control somehow.
Interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great example too, Stuart, by the way. As somebody who has a fear of flying, I can definitely relate to that. So we know that that is true, that one of the biggest determinants of whether a person's response to stress will be harmful or ultimately resilient is whether they feel they have a sense of control. And so what I'm interested in and recommend to people is that they really broaden their definition of control, because a lot of the things that cause stress in our lives, we don't have the kind of active control over where we can make things turn out the way we want them to. But there are always things that we can have influence over. We have influence of what we choose to pay attention to. We have control over how we interpret a situation. We have control over how we respond. And there is almost always a way to respond to a stressful situation that is strengthening. And it might be by choosing to talk to someone about what you're going through, which is part of our natural stress instincts, to seek support or to seek connection. And maybe we choose that response to stress because we can control that, even though we can't control the situation. And I think that's really what stress mindset is about, and one of the reasons why people who have this more accepting attitude towards stress end up faring better in a wide range of stressful situations, including the ones that you can't control. Because when you choose to trust yourself to handle the situation and you try to find a positive way to respond or to see some benefit in the situation, that you're actually taking back control. And we know that the most toxic, stressful situations are the ones that feel outside of your control and against your will and isolating. And so mindset can be a way to get back that sense of control, even in situations where you don't have the kind of autonomy to make it exactly the way you hope it would be.
Now, and that brings us back to the social connection thing. And I know we're kind of coming towards the end of the hour, and I want to make sure we touch on the chemical aspect of the oxytocin that is released in, that's one of the hormones that is really affected by stress. And I really want to hear you talk about the importance of this social connection and how it really is integral in the stress, response relationship that we have, yeah, and how important it is. And also, could you touch on whether or not maybe women are affected differently by stress? I don't know. It made me just think when I was reading it that there's maybe less of a health hazard for women because we talk more with our buddies. Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, well, so let's start with the oxytocin. You know, people know about a lot of stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol, but your brain and body are releasing other hormones during stress, including oxytocin, which is a neurohormone that really fine-tunes our social instincts. It tends to make us want to be around people we trust and care about. It also makes us more willing to help others we care about. It makes us better able to read other people's facial expressions and have empathy. And most importantly, it's like a chemical of courage. Oxytocin makes us willing to take positive risks to support or defend or protect the things we care about, including the people we care about. And when oxytocin is released during stress, it actually increases the sense of hope and courage that we feel, and it also makes us want to be social. And some of the really interesting research coming out of sort of how do you get better at stress suggests that if you can tap into this side of the stress response, so when you're feeling anxious or angry or overwhelmed, you think, all right, well, who can I talk to receive support? Or even better, who else is stressed out right now? And what's something I can do to help or support them? That actually creates even more that biology of courage and hope that makes us feel better able to handle the stress in our own lives. And so, I often encourage people to, in moments when they're feeling overwhelmed by their own stress, which is one way that the body and brain responds to stress, to think, well, there's this other stress response. In the science, it's called the tend and befriend response that actually makes you braver and makes you stronger. And you can kickstart it by choosing to connect with others or choosing to help someone else out.
And women,
by the way, are more likely to do this naturally. But the studies show that when men do it, they benefit just as much. Women are more likely to have this as sort of their dominant stress response.
And either it was in the TED Talk or in the book that you referred to a study that showed that it actually has shown benefits in life expectancy.
Yeah. So for example, there are studies looking at the role that major stressful life events such as unemployment or divorce or your own whatever's going on in your life that's really stressful, whether or not that predicts health problems and also mortality risk. And many studies have shown that people who regularly care for others or people who volunteer regularly show absolutely no stress-related increase in health problems, that they seem to be protected, not protected against everything in life, but they're protected somehow from what we usually think of as being the toxic effects of adversity or life stress. And, I wanted to come back to someone had made a comment, I don't know if it was a blog post or an email, about caregiver stress. And caregiver stress is one of the most difficult forms of stress to deal with because there's so much that we care about and also so much suffering present too. And as someone who has gone through caregiving stress, and I work a lot with people who are caregivers and overwhelmed by it, I'd say it's a particularly complex form of stress to try to embrace. But I do want to say that study suggests that the long-term effect of caregiving is often protective, even when the short-term effects are draining and harmful, and that the best way to get through that caregiver stress is to try to hold on to the opposites, to not deny how hard it is and how much suffering is present, but also to choose to see the meaning in it. One study that I love found that you could, caregivers who were depressed, if they spent 1 minute at the end of every day recording on their phones one thing that they felt good about that they had done as a caregiver that day, or one thing that was uplifting, that they actually relieved people who'd been clinically depressed as a result of being a caregiver. So I want to acknowledge that it's a very complicated form of stress, but that there are ways to use your stress mindset to help bring some hope and some meaning to a situation that is very difficult.
All right. Let's go to some of the emails. We have a whole lot of them here, so let me pour through a bunch of them. One listener writes, Winston Churchill is reputed to have said, "I love a man who grins while he's fighting." Maybe he's on to something. Of course, he was interested in performance and not health and longevity, but maybe there's a connection. Another listener writing says, for me,
that's a perfect example of holding opposites, by the way, that you are going to bring a smile or joy to something that is intrinsically difficult.
Yeah. It didn't sound like he was too stressed out about having his bourbon and cigar at the end of the day with his cheesecake and whiskey champagne, Tina's telling me. Another listener writes, for me, there are two main categories of stress. One is stress about a situation I can affect. The second is stress over events or situations which I cannot affect. The latter is bad for my health.
Yes, that's actually, it's more accurate. That is definitely the case. And yet there are ways to sort of work with that experience of stress so that it becomes less toxic.
And what would that be? I guess giving it over, saying I can't affect this, so
Let
it go.
And another is to try to transform it into compassion. Compassion is a version of a stress response that actually is quite healthy for us, even though it may also be distressing. An example of the type of stress that a lot of people feel is toxic is watching the news. and seeing, you know, how many horrible things are happening, the injustices and the violence, the natural disasters. And people can feel very overwhelmed by that. You know, just watching the news is a good predictor of anxiety and depression among people. And there are studies showing that in that moment where you know there's nothing that you can do, if you connect to the part of you that actually cares for people who are suffering, sort of the positive version of that, and let yourself feel that desire for people to experience less suffering, that actually transforms the physiology of your stress response. And it doesn't require, you know, being in denial of the fact that there's all this going on that you can't control.
Or despair. And I think that there are.
Yeah. And in the book, I try to talk about a lot of mindset shifts like that because, you know, stress, it's everything in life that we don't want to experience. And so there's going to be no one size fits all strategy for transforming that stress into something that is less harmful and that is more beneficial. But there is a mindset reset for any form of stress.
All right. We only have in the remaining 30 seconds before I have to start closing out. Kelly McGonigal, can you offer up a couple words of wisdom for those that want to see the upside of stress?
Yeah, I think, you know, one study I haven't mentioned was a study that came out 2 years ago that looked at the relationship between meaning and stress. And what they found was that if you want to know how meaningful a person's life is, you should ask them about their stress. And no matter how you ask about stress, higher levels of adversity in people's past, even the amount of time people spend worrying about the future, they all increase the chance that someone will say that their lives are meaningful. And I think that that really gets to the paradox of stress, that even though we often wish we could have a stress-free life, that a meaningful life is often stressful. And just remembering that in moments of stress can help us deal with the stress in a way that allows us to really engage our goals and our values more helpfully.
All right. That's Kelly McGonigal, author of The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. Thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Penny.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from David Marks. Our interns are Nunu Teo and Megan Sussman. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Penny Nelson in for Mina Kim. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.